Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Bose is the presenting partner of Beyond the Grid. That's because Bose Quiet Comfort 35-2 goes beyond what you would expect from a pair of headphones. Just flip the switch to experience the industry-leading active noise reduction feature, and all distractions of the world around you fade away, allowing you to focus fully on what matters to you.
Hi, I'm Mark Webber, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hello all, it's TC here with another episode and another driver who our Aussie listeners might call a ripper of a guest. It's Mark Webber, a man whose commitment on track was matched by his one-liners off it. During his career, he won 9 Grand Prix for Red Bull and a sports car world championship for Porsche, and he's now retired and doesn't have a race license of any kind. We caught up at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, so if you hear the roar of engines, that's why. We've known each other for 20-odd years, and I've interviewed Mark hundreds of times, but never like this. And if you want headlines to lure you in, think Vettel, Alonso, Schumacher, they're all in there, and he has interesting things to say about each of them. He speaks directly and honestly, and still with so much passion for the sport. And as you'd expect of someone who's taken to TV punditry so seamlessly, he's a great listen. Well, Mark, welcome to Beyond the Grid. I just want to start by reflecting a little bit, really. You've been retired now for a wee bit of time. How do you look back on it all? Is it a bit of a dream sometimes?
Definitely. I think, when you get older, you get more secure in a way. You get more, less tolerant of things that could have been trivial in the past and aren't so trivial now. So things that might have been a bit of a beat up, whether it's professionally, personally, I think only hopefully get a little bit more mature, which racing drivers are quite late on that in many ways, or can be. It's amazing how fast it goes, which is obviously everyone knows that, how quickly time goes. But also, I feel like a pretty different person to when as the competitor I was. Like, I'm really, I do see it nearly in sort of two halves.
How have you changed?
Much more relaxed, much more, open, and just, I want to use a better word than selfish, but in terms of just, driven and all those things, which I've still got traits of those, no question about it, but in terms of when I was racing, I believe that I was on this one-way journey to maximise my potential and get everything I could out of myself. I'd come a long way from Australia. I'd invested so much of my the level of talent that I had, I suppose, and the graft and the currents that I put towards myself at getting better. And the people around me as well had been sensational, from my immediate family through to Anne. So you sort of feel that it is absolutely now or never, often, in car racing. And especially as it's a big individual sport, so I felt that was pivotal for me to do that, because there were sections of my profession that didn't come natural to me, like being fast sometimes. Like, I was reasonably fast.
What do you mean?
I was fast, but I just, like, when you get to the last few guys, obviously, when we're talking about Seb and Lewis and Fernando and Michael and, you know, JB, and, like, I was so, so happy to have hung out with that generation of driver, because they took me to a point that I probably never would have went to myself. So to close all that off, I was not the best multitasker. So socially and sort of having the brackets of actually, you know, having good nights out and rah rah, I was actually very narrow when I was competing. Because I just saw it as I wanted to race as long as I possibly could, because I love that. I loved the competition. I was a competitor. I loved competing. I actually was. And I wanted to have that for as long as I could. And I wanted to stop when I felt that I was driving at a good level, but didn't want to be like an old boxer that felt like, oh, here we go, and we're going to go back down through the grid, which I did on the way up. I don't want to do that on the way back down. My last Grand Prix, I finished on the podium with Fernando and Sebastian. I got the fastest lap of the race in Brazil. And that was a really nice way to finish my Grand Prix career. Disney sports car racing, which I loved from a team component wise. And then you're now in this absolutely second chapter of, let's say in the English way, of one's life, Tom, of one's life, second chapter.
How is normal life by comparison? Do you enjoy life more now than you did as a racing driver?
Really tough question. The initial reaction is yes, I do, because inherently you have a lot of pressure to do a job like that, but that's what we love doing. I love the competitive side. I love working with a team. I love surprising. We love surprising the competition. They had something better coming. So there was lots of things which was so, so rewarding and engaging. And you don't realize when you work with the best how fortunate you were and race against the best and work in, you know, such an incredible industry like Formula One is and was still. Then you come out of that and all those disciplines and standards going into, let's call it, Civvy Street to a degree, can be challenging. But naturally, you're still trying to surround yourself with those type of people in whatever walks of life you do when you finish, which I have. The sport continues to give for me. I've got great people and partners around me since I've stopped racing. That took planning and effort. That doesn't come to you. Of course, you've got to work hard at that. But I'm enjoying the personal side is unquestionably better. Unquestionably better. The private, the professional side, I miss parts of my profession. I do. But I get frustrated as hell that I know that I'm not going to be able to do what I used to be able to do. And you just have to let it go. I've got a good friend, Pat Rafter, tennis player. He said, mate, it's called fucking reality. That's how it is. You cannot drive a Monaco Grand Prix and get pole when you're 43 or 40. It hasn't been done. Well, in the modern general, in the last sort of 15 years. Because you don't get any better. It gets harder. And one of my biggest heroes, look at Valentino Rossi right now. We all love Valentino, but he can race. His experience is just hanging him in there on Sunday afternoons. But out and outright speed, he's not there. As it once was. He knows that. He's got to be crafty with the chess set now. And to hang with Marquez on one lap is not possible. So you see it over and over and over again in sport. And
You said you've got to let go. Is it true that you don't even have a race license now?
Yeah, I don't.
I mean, that's letting go to an extreme, isn't it?
It's amazing how even things like wearing racing suits, wearing helmets, if I can get away with that, I do. I've nearly gone that far detached from. Look, I like driving fast, don't get me wrong. I like, if you've got a buggy on a farm, acreage, bit of fun, buggies, dirt bikes, look, throttle in my hand, I have got petrol in my veins. There's no question about that. But I just feel this huge departure from racing in Formula One is extremely, extremely hard to replace. And I want to try and keep that in the bank for as long as possible, in a way. Porsche have asked me so many times, what about driving the GT car? Not really, no. I don't really want it because there's people who can do a job in it and I'm just going to be frustrated how early I've got to brake, how long I've got to wait till I get back on the throttle and how slow the lap time's going to be.
You were an intense racing driver. Fair comment?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Which I've just said pretty much.
Yeah. Do you think you would, if you'd been less intense, you might have been a better racing driver? Did you try and force the door open sometimes when it just didn't want to open? And
yeah, I think that probably one of my biggest weaknesses was I was intense, but and that's right, that is a really good word for me, I suppose. But in terms of, I believed I could do the job. I did believe I could do a very, very, very good job. And sometimes, and it's a horrible word in motorsport and a horrible word in most professional sports, but if the old she'll be right mentality, like certain she'll be rights, like I will get, there were certain briefings or certain things, it's like, should I prep a bit more on that? Should I do a bit more prep on that? No, I'll cover that off tomorrow. I'll be fine. And that's the little chink, I suppose, where if I had my time again, the Stewart-esque approach, the Prost-esque approach, the Vettel-esque approach, you know, the guys that, and all those guys might not have been the fastest single. I mean, Lewis and Lewis is fast, but in terms of his application of the job, you can argue how much work he puts in here and there, but ultimately he's got unbelievable skill. But for me to, in terms of feel and skill, not the whole technical side and getting the team around him, which is obviously good. So there's so many dynamics to our profession which are important. I believe that there wasn't many mechanics that worked on my car that didn't enjoy working for me. I think a lot of mechanics did. I enjoyed driving their cars and we had a good bond on that. There was lots of things which, and some people don't have that. Some guys, that's a huge component that doesn't go. So I suppose if I had it again, mate, less intense. There was things which I thought was overbearing or more overbearing that I just built up more tension than was probably needed to be there. And I think because I just wanted the space, I wanted to drive, and you can't have that. It's like, that's the profession, you know, and I tell that to young guys now, and I tell them exactly this, and you know, this is a profession, you know, it's just part of it. What was really funny was after the Korean Grand Prix in 13, I think the car caught fire again, and all the drivers were on a jet, which I'd organised, which was a great trip across from Korea to Japan, and we went out on we had a massive night on the Sunday night. Massive.
Who? Really? When big. You say all the drivers, mate,
it was 70% of the grid.
Right.
70% of the grid were there. Massive night. And we were all dusty on Monday, to say the least. We were Monday off. We decided there was a select, so we're back down to there was probably about six or seven of them again on Tuesday night. We went again. This is my last year in F1.
You knew at this point that you were quitting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the announcement was out. But talking about your intense scenario. So I had two massive benders and I qualified on pole to Suzuka on Saturday. Like, and I said to myself, maybe I did miss the sweet spot here. Of course, you know, that was borderline James Hunt sort of spec, you know, without the crumpet. But in terms of the alcohol we consumed, you know, we had a real big crack at that week. And I'm like, okay, maybe I could have been a bit less intense. But it was hard, yeah, to not be. Because that's, you know, call it, I don't know, is it a chip on the shoulder? Is it something, you know, the Australians, or we've come that far? I don't know, mate. I just feel that there's so much at stake and you feel that you can get bogged down in not letting anything chance, really, and that's why the intensity comes across.
Well, in terms of your dealings with the media, I certainly felt that there was only one other driver who outwardly wanted it as much as you, and that was Fernando Alonso. Yeah. I thought you two were the a class apart from everybody else when you were together. But let's talk teammates. Can you compare Rosberg and Vettel? Or are they just light years different?
No, both same nationality, which is important because the way they sort of go about their trade in terms of understanding and questioning and getting to the bottom of technical matters, or, you know, clearly making the car go faster, which is the job we all had. Nico was in his first year in F1. I think he didn't have the belief that Vettel had. I didn't see the belief and the hunger that Vettel had early doors. I think Nico needed much longer to confirm to himself that he belonged there. Where Vettel said, "I fucking belong here. I am here. This is going to happen."
Helped by his victory at Monza,
big, yeah. So he had a lot of success fast, and I remember Nico in Budapest just after. We're just about to go into the August break in 06, and Kirky said he needs this break. He's mentally, this is intense. Formula One's intense. Nico was on the edge, I think, in that first 8 months at Williams, in terms of, you know, we're having technicals, and it was not that smooth. So that was, it was a tough introduction for him. And you could see he was green into it. And again, just that desire, I've seen the desire and hunger, you know, how much of it really was him. And you saw that later on, how much he had to put into that, of course. It wasn't overly, maybe over natural for Nico, but he got the job done and he had to find ways to trick his head to get that hunger and fire and belief and get that going and come out of the old man's shadows, I suppose, or all those things which are the top typical questions that he would get asked. Sebastian, much, much more, probably, as they are always now, you know, that every sort of 5-6 year blocks, we get the guys arriving more complete. And Sebastian was more complete, even though he arrived only 3 years later after Nico. But, yeah, I didn't work with Sebastian, you know, obviously in 08. Actually, Seb tested the Williams in, I think it was 05, off the back of, yeah, and he was rabbit in the headlights. Obviously, that was way too early in Jerez, and he said, this is not for me. This is so quick. Obviously, his head fell off in 3 minutes flat, and he couldn't hang on to it physically. He wasn't there. Yeah, he had that little snapshot of exposure early doors, and that can be a pivotal thing because you have to... So he had exposure to how brutal it was going to be. Then he could go away and think about that for a year and a half and say, you know, this is... The intimidation factor was ginormous, which was a good thing because he certainly respected when it's going to come back again, I need to get my ducks lined up. And being the calculating individual that Sebastian is, he doesn't forget much. So... that would have been a nice entry for him.
Is he an honest guy with his teammates? Was he playing funny games? Was he political with you directly? I mean, there was the whole Red Bull thing, but I feel that's almost a sideshow to what I'm asking you now.
He was...
Would he mislead you on setup and stuff?
He was extremely creative with run plans, with... You know, he would certainly get his engineers on side to... It was them and us. Like, there was times where you would plug into, like, okay, well, this is in the interest of the team in terms of development. It'll make the car go quick. You know, it was a different... It wasn't as open as it could be. And you know what? I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that because, you know, we were the same pretty much on the other side, and that's what drove you both on to get the best out of what it was. And that was up to then the management, as you say, then the next level up to try and, you know, massage that together, which was no mean task. We've seen so many times that just often ends in tears, which, you know, not only engineering, dynamics, the team, the wall between the teams, teams within the team, which is can be a disaster to manage. So, he had flashes of a meltdown. Sebastian has had those and does have those. So I think he has a plan. And often these meltdowns are around scenarios where it's outside a normal routine of a Grand Prix. I mean, a race, so safety cars.
Right. Yeah. Fuji 07.
Yeah.
That would come under this particular list, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And relations didn't get off to a great start, let's face it.
No.
I remember you in the media talking...
Yeah. I can't remember the quote. Was it kids? Yeah.
The damn kids coming in?
Well, that was a bizarre one. I mean, Lewis was really at fault to a degree in terms that he was yo-yoing around. I think McLaren had some different brake material, and it was a cold day, it was raining, it was a disgusting Grand Prix. I had food poisoning on the day. I was feeling pretty rough. In Australia, we call that lower shark shit, so that's pretty low, pretty low on average. And we got through so much of the difficult part of the Grand Prix, all the aquaplaning. I mean, there was still... But Fernando shunted, you know, which was rare. There was a lot of... tricky moments throughout the race. There was podium for sure, which was unheard of. A Red Bull and a Toros on the podium together, like, this was like, it'd never been done before. And I put up a sign, Lewis, in the last sector there, saying, mate, the gap to the safety car is ginormous. Like, basically I was looking at him saying, mate, you know, you need to, like, come on, this is, the lights are still on, it's not like we're doing a restart. We're still under safety car conditions, and he was pulling a long way back and mucking around. So I put up beside him. Next minute, boom, you know, on the safety car, just absolutely harpooned the back of me, and Sebastian and I went out. I know Seb was bawling his eyes out up, that he was shattered. So that happened. Abu Dhabi, he's been off behind the safety car, hitting DRS boards. We saw Azerbaijan. So it's amazing how he's this maximum intense, this focus and concentration that he can do, and winning off pole off the front, breaking the DRS back in the day. I mean, that was his signature punch. He was deadly with that. But as soon as there was another connotation in there, it became a little bit more tricky. And the other one was interesting in terms of my qualifying record against him when it was one or two time laps in Q3. Is it one lap or two laps? He hated that because it wasn't bang, bang, German, like, what's clear? Is it clear or is it not clear? It's still a little bit open. Other tyres are already on the first lap. Maybe we'll do two. Is it going to be one timed and then we'll do, or two timed and we'll do one time? And he often hated that. So it's amazing how there was chinks. Also, his in-laps, braking for the pit lane limiter, poor. I would smash him every time.
You would brake later?
Every time. He was always building up to where I would go to.
Yeah, but
to
did you get a bit of a cricket score in terms of fines or not?
No. I'm talking break into the line.
But you didn't get done for speed.
No, never on the entry. But he was very poor at judging that braking distance away from... Yeah, like... Yeah. How can you guys be so good but on that he was actually very mediocre, and I would put pressure
right the way through.
Yeah, it took him a long time to get up to it, and that was obviously something again that I would not show until I needed to, of course. So that's the other side, that, you know, that's what you do, right? So Nico and those two guys were very, very different, and I would finish or round it all that out, Tom, with just, I suppose, the belief, desire and hunger, and ultimately a bigger competitor. Fidel's a bigger competitor
than Rosberg. Yeah. Okay, right, so next question then is,
which takes up, so not that Nico's not a competitor, but yeah.
Were you surprised that Rosberg quit the way he did?
Very.
But knowing him as he did, and the way Keke told you that halfway through year one he was mentally exhausted?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, he just, the levels that he had to go to get the job done, which he did, whatever it was, like he talks about sleeping in different rooms to his wife and all this, I mean, just amazing personal sacrifice to next level. There's sacrifice and there's like, wow, he really did do a lot. Fine, fair enough. So then how long is that sustainable? Can you do that for 13 years? Clearly not. So did he do it for 5 years? Probably. And he said in his head that, you know, when he got to the end of that year, I mean, he must have went through, I mean, I think that Abu Dhabi race mentally tortured him. He openly says that. So mentally it was torture. And
well, with Lewis backing him up.
He didn't want to go through that again.
Yeah.
So that was a serious amount of medication that Lewis dished out there. And I think that he stopped too young. Nico should have kept racing. But there's only one person who made that call. That's him.
Okay. Who was the best driver you ever raced against?
Raced against Sunday afternoons, I would probably say Fernando. Extremely creative, mixed it up, whether in offense or defense, whether you were trying to get the job done on him, always mixing it up in front, like just moving his, what we call, you know, the disturbed air. So, you know, you could not get your wing in clean air behind him because he was always mixing it up. And then when we had Kurz on top of that, he was very good at moving that round. So you could never settle on behind him, really. It was quite a good battle. And he never gave up. Like Fernando, I cannot even count when he locked up and missed an apex in front of me. Like if he had an easy pass. Like you never had, you know, when you did that. So he was... Fernando Alonso on Sunday afternoon. I don't know if he's done two or three wins in his whole career. Incredible record. He is a brilliant, brilliant racing driver. Over one lap, there's better. Over managing the whole teams, in terms of getting the whole team, you know, with your Superman cape on and we're going to go and do this, there could be better. But when it comes to just plug and play, Sunday afternoons, exceptional. Obviously, Michael was... I had a few battles with Michael. Again, that was intense. But you never knew if there might have been your cheap shot here and there, you know. Yeah, there was very rarely a cheap shot for Fernando.
Well, talking of cheap shots, Monaco 2-6.
Yeah,
exactly. You were very outspoken about that at the time.
Outrageous. I mean,
even now,
to do that,
12 years old.
To do that to your colleagues, I think that that was a real slap in the face for us, that, you know, it was Kimi, Fernando, and myself sort of trying to get that last, where Michael had fast the last few rows, sort of out of Monaco there. Like, you just ask yourself the question, like, why? Like, and just how sharp he is. If he drops 2/10 of the half chicane, and then he's got tobacco and swimming pool, and it's like, okay, so there's somewhere in there he's going to do some choreography to fuck this session. Which Monaco, always your last sets are quicker. Your last set of tyres is generally going to go faster, which Michael knew that he dropped the ball on it. But, yeah, and I went to see him in Silverstone a few weeks later. I said, you know, went to Sabine. I said, I'd love to talk to Michael, which we did. Michael was great. I went to see him. He said, look, you know, sometimes you go down a road that you can't turn back out. I said, well, we need to tell that to all the guys. Like, you know, we need to talk to the GPA.
So man, that was him holding his hand up.
Yeah.
I knew what I was doing, Mark.
Yeah.
And I knew I was screwing you over. And
well, I said to him, you didn't even crash the car because you think of the mechanics. You didn't even, you know, so you could see the whole thing was executed with a bit of hesitation. And educated eye, like, oh my God, mate, this is just, you know. So, and I just said to him in that meeting, Michael, why, Michael, why? Like, just, you're so gifted. You know, I've often used it, mate, like, it's that paranoid perfection.
Yeah.
That was Michael.
I hope this doesn't seem like a silly question, but did you like him as a person? I mean, given what you just said.
I never got that close to Michael. I have very good friends of mine that loved being with Michael, and he had unbelievable great qualities. There's no question about it, Michael Schumann. He has great qualities. You know, he was a colossal individual for our sport. He was on his own. Schumacher, the name in Formula One, there was no one else. Mika was racing with the DC was racing, but Michael Schumacher globally, like, unbelievable what he meant for our sport and Ferrari and the whole juggernaut. He was massive. So for him to let his guard down with the odd competitor, or especially individuals or media, not easy. So you have to appreciate that. But he, I think he had a lot of sensational qualities. Unfortunately, when the helmet is on, obviously sometimes his judgments were poor. We saw that, and the old thing, yeah, why? Like, you know, why Adelaide? Why Jerez? Why Monaco? Why Bits and Bobs? Why Rubens at Budapest? Why? Every now and again, it's just like, we would all love to raise those out and be the Federer. But Federer is different. It's a different sport. Roger is what he is, but Michael is in that, in terms of trophy cabinet, in terms of sheer reinventing himself, did a very, very good job.
You're saying, can you not be Federer in our sport? You just wouldn't make it. You just wouldn't find...
Well, who has been the club? Jackie Stewart was Federer, wasn't he? Yeah. Jackie Shaw was Federer.
Yeah. Was Prost? Was Senna?
No. No. I don't think they were Federer, because it is hard. There's a lot of technical, when I talk about, you know, team, harmony and inertia and momentum around you getting that on board, what does that mean? Do you have to use the media sometimes? Absolutely. Hitting a tennis ball didn't involve that. You know? And I'm not, you know, belittling. I mean, I love my tennis mate, as you know. Federer's a icon of modern day sport, but our sport, and you can't get close, because getting close and showing that much respect, and when you are at 330 kilometres an hour, you know, Fernando and I, we did a lot of that, but we're never really, really as close as the media picked up to. You know, I don't care what anyone says, if you're wheel to wheel with your brother, like if you're really wheel to wheel with your brother, it's going to affect your decisions. So you are softer with some guys than others. There's some guys you just didn't really like. So that was really, really, you know, you would really give it a hard time.
You said that you and Fernando perhaps weren't as close as the media made you out to be. Mm. But there were, tell me if I'm wrong, a couple of times when you really could have been closer. The first of those was Renault.
Yep.
Talk us through why you chose to go to Williams ahead of Renault, and that... Does that really suck when you look back?
It was a stuff-up, big stuff-up. Flavio was like... Renault had not won any races at that point. You know, so it's interesting to say, like, Williams had just, you know, 03, 04, been pretty competitive. Renault were, like, just trying to come through. So when we got to Melbourne, we said that was a poor decision, because...
You knew immediately.
I physically won the race.
Well, but
Giancarlo won.
And you knew that Williams weren't going to close the gap. And
I knew in Valencia, we went there, and the amount of fuel we were taking out of the car, because how slow the car was. Like, we were like trying to be quick, and Williams were losing sponsors, and it's like, oh my God. I remember ringing Dad up at the back of the garage going, Dad, we're in a world of pain here. World of pain. And that was coming from a harmonious, yet not overly structured, disciplined Jaguar setup, in terms of, you know, we were still, you know, clearly finding their way, and obviously Red Bull bought them out. But so what was the screw ups there? The screw ups was emotionally, what a drive for Frank and Patrick. Very excited about that. I should have went for the, well, I should have listened to Flavio at that time, saying that, you know, we've got to give this a go.
But why Williams? Why the attraction to Williams? Was it an Alan Jones thing, an Aussie thing?
A little bit of that, a little bit of, you know, they did a good pitch, I suppose. You look at it like that, it was like, yeah, we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that. And at the end of the day, it didn't work out like that. And so that was a screw up. It wasn't even better conditions. I had better conditions at Renault as well. So it was no good story, mate. Any of it.
Well, so, that was the first time. And then, tell me if I'm wrong, was there another time when you could have been
Ferrari,
in red? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah.
Why didn't it?
So off the back of around that Singapore 09 race, which was obviously an interesting evening, say the least, there was a lot of pressure on Flavio's drivers, and Fernando and I stayed with Flavio through a lot of that. There was immense pressure from the FIA and from Max, and obviously, you know, Flavio got moved on, but in terms of, you know, the drivers around him, and Flavio saw a bit of loyalty on that. Obviously I was furious with what happened, but he still saw some loyalty on my side in terms of, you know, going forward. And he said that, I would love, before you finish racing, we've got to get a Ferrari drive.
And your reaction to that?
Brilliant. Absolutely.
But I mean, like every other racing driver, the lure of Ferrari was there for you
absolutely.
As well. As strong as it was to go to Frank and Patrick.
I'd love to do that. I'd love to do bigger than probably than any situation I've been in. But also the loyalty factor to Dietrich was ginormous. Because Dietrich has been and still is to this day a great guy for me. Been brilliant. I've learnt a lot off Dietrich. So Barcy started to get a bit of momentum. It was around 11 Monaco. Renters 11 at Monaco, and they were keen on some Red Bull staff, obviously, so they're trying to get some Red Bull people to come as well.
One in particular?
Well, Peter Prodromou was in the crosshairs. He was an aerodynamic guy doing the front wings at the time for Red Bull. Still is, I think he's at McLaren now. So there's a couple of guys I were interested in. I think also Ferrari were looking to even have potentially a bit of an aerodynamic / wind tunnel set up in the UK at the time. So it was, they wanted some HR, some reinforcements on the personnel side, and I said, look, I'm out of contract with Red Bull. I'd love to go to Ferrari. Fernando's there, fine, whatever. Was it going to be number two? It looked pretty solid, like it was going to be a number two, but I thought, okay. Ferrari's tough to say no. I'm definitely probably going to win some races with Ferrari, even if you're a straight number two, I could win some races. But there was nothing in the contract that was spoke about being number two status.
So what made you think it was going to be?
Well, obviously Fernando's been, there's no way in a million years he had the best car. Fernando being there for 3 or 4 years, you're going to win the championship with Fernando. Like, it's a bit like, I suppose, now with Seb, like, you know, the work that's gone out of Ferrari, he's going to be the only guy that's going to win the championship, and it's going to happen, right? So we agreed, figures were there, it was all good, it was all sweet. And then what they changed their tune on was, it wasn't 2 years fixed, it was one-on-one, so option on the second year. So I'm not happy about that. Neither was Flavio. So around Canada time, I started to get a little bit, my gut was like, I don't know how hungry they are. Luca Montezemolo wanted me to go and see him personally in Italy, very short notice, which Flavio said, no, Mark, doesn't need to. There's nothing complicated about this, Luca. Just sign the contract as it is.
So you were dealing with Luca Montezemolo, not Stefano Domenico?
Initially, Stefano in Monaco. We had meetings on the boat. And then Luca and Flavio were dealing with it. And then I think that Bernie, Dietrich, Christian all started to get a bit of wind of it, and then it all started to shut down. Now, I don't know if that was because Seb was going there. I don't know if it was Robert going there. There was lots of connotations at the time about it, because that seat was quite... Fernando was obviously, as he is, trying to get these people in place. And I was part of the agenda, clearly, about bringing lap time to all Ferrari. Okay, I can bring some Red Bull IP in my own mind, head, you know, my IP in terms of that. And a big thing for me was, I said, Flavio, I need to sit in the car before we sign this contract, because I'm worried if I won't fit in it, because I know it's very small. It was a big topic for me. No, it'll be okay. So very nervous about that. It's fine to say that. Let's just get it done. We'll sort it out later. Which, probably a bit of truth in that, in terms of, once you got the contract done, then they'll have to sort it out, because they're going to change the car. It's their problem, not yours. You know? Anyway, very, very quickly, Red Bull started to get a bit more intense, and the Ferrari thing was, you know, I said, I don't want to be sitting here in Monaco in 6 months' time going that the option's not going to be renewed for whatever reason. And at that time, Porsche was starting to come on the scene at 12, and around that 12 period as well, so I was like, oh yeah. I could either have potentially 15 years with Porsche, or 1 year with Ferrari, or whatever. You know, I was trying to look at all connotations.
So it was actually the Porsche thing that stopped you taking it, rather than the Red Bull thing in a way.
There was a few things. There was a 1+1, which wasn't good. I was happy with the conditions. I was very keen to drive for Maranello. No question about it. Jack Brabham. Jack, I saw Jack in Melbourne, I think. It was one of the... He said, if you drive for these, I'll be pissed off. So Jack was furious.
Why?
Furious. He said, I spent my whole life trying to beat these bastards. Right, yeah. Why are you going to drive for them? Jack was not happy about it. Porsche, yep. A lot of different little topics in there, saying, okay, well, I just don't think this is right. And I drove for Red Bull for 2 more years. I don't regret the Ferrari call at all. I think the Red Bull exit slash, you know, departing. You know, still, I've never been closer to Red Bull.
So you went on to Porsche. We talked about Porsche.
Yep.
You've done the deal. How difficult was it for you to go back to Le Mans with Porsche after the shunts you had there in 99?
Difficult, yeah, because they were extremely traumatic crashes. Emotionally, the most brutal probably period of my career, because it does flash before you. Life does flash before you, so you're going to go back to the same venue. It's amazing what the mind can... It puts it into capsules in terms of a closed car again, the scenarios there, how's it going to feel? It's fine pretty much on your own, but again, if you've got to start racing hard and going inside people and doing this and doing that. So I needed to be pretty strong mentally, let's say, but I knew once I got through that first part, I'd be okay. But it is to be said, I never really, and still to this day, haven't got a love affair with Le Mans.
Because of those flips, that
probably that. That was tough, but it also was important for me to show I can come back from. I remember Terry Boutsen saying that, I think at the time, he'll never recover from it mentally, those two shunts within a day, and they were sort of like a bit of fuel on the fire. And
did you ever recover mentally?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Boutsen was wrong.
Yeah. But it was nice to go, all right, well, I respect him, no question. He's driven F1, one race in F1, okay, and there was a few guys like, how the hell is this guy going to get over it? And then I had Mercedes, and because then I was going to go and maybe drive for IndyCar. Norbert Harvey was looking at IndyCar, and then Greg Moore had signed a Penske contract, and Greg Moore got killed that year in Fontana. So it was like, 99 was a tough year emotionally, because the momentum was going out of my career, and I had no chips on the table. I had nothing to show. You know, I was hassled on the shootout of Eddie Jordan. Eddie then introduced me to Paul Stoddard, and then blah, blah, blah.
And the rest is history. But you talk about your mental strength of going back to Le Mans. From the moment I saw you recover from that broken leg, the way you did that, absolutely no chance you were going to have a problem mentally going back to Le Mans. I mean, when we talk about that leg now, you know, and that took just the fight to come back. You had a new teammate, and it's all
Was nasty. And the surgery wasn't great to start with, so that was tough, because obviously, and that's, you know, the poor guy, the poor surgeon in Hobart was obviously extremely nervous. It was a reasonably straightforward procedure, but still had, you know, you can get the orthopedics a little bit off, which he did. And unbeknownst to me, I found out, you know, later that there was a few things which were a bit amiss with the work in the knee, in the leg, in the knee joint area, and also at the fracture site. So that was like a massive kick in the nuts, because it's like, shit, the clock's ticking. I was putting the work in, and when I got some other advice from orthopedics, they said, look, Mark, we're going to have to reset the clock here and do some more work. And I remember I think Michael was there at that test. I wanted to...
The first one back, Jerez. I'll never forget it. I was there. You hobbled to the car. You did 80 laps.
First day off crutches that day, because I wanted to show Dietrich that I wasn't on crutches.
You did 80 on lap.
He was very keen to make sure there was no crutches to be seen. And I remember him telling me that when I was in Tasmanian Hospital. So it's fine. He was brilliant. He said, mate, we're not going to do... And that was another reason about the Ferrari, because, like, Dietrich, you know, literally I was in the shit. Like, I was in hospital, ribs, shoulder, you know, contusion in the left lung, leg snapped in half. Dietrich's like, we're going to wait for you. I hadn't won a race at that point. Brilliant quality. So, and then I remembered I had a bit of orthopedic work about a week before I went to the test, and I said to the surgeon, Dave Hahn, I said, Dave, mate, we have so screwed this up, mate. I'm in so much pain now. Why am I in so much pain? He goes, beautiful. Exactly what I wanted to hear. He said, the fracture site now is, you are now, it's starting to dynamite, starting to heal, because the way I was set up before, it was never going to heal for yourself. So I was like, oh my God, like the pain in my leg. He said, yep, I know. And I remember getting these tablets when I was in... I was moved to two different hospitals, and I'm jumping around a bit here, mate. But anyway, I was moved in... I was in Tasmania for a week, and then I went to another hospital for a week in Victoria at Vimy House. The AFL guys put me in, which was a great setup. I woke up one night, and the leg was just massive, swollen, just pressure on it, temperature. And I said to the nurse, I need some pain relief, because I was very, very low on the morphine. I was very... I just... Again, just trying to be... Just... tough it out. You know, I don't need all this chemicals and help. But this one night I was in misery, and she gave me these tablets called Endone, which people will know, a lot of the listeners will know what Endone is. Very powerful. And I thought to myself, shit, I'm going to keep some of these for when I've got to get back in the car. And then I asked the doctors, you know, so I remember the name, and obviously still to this day, because it was a magic medication, pills, because it was so powerful. And obviously you had to get the dosage right, because crack addicts, I think, have this stuff crushed down, right? So it's a bloody serious potion. And they said, there's no way you're going in a Grand Prix car having had this medication. Oh, okay. So I didn't do that, because it was obviously a pretty powerful. But yeah, and also, mate, so I got to the car, the middle of my shin bone was just, it just was like on fire, and sharp pain in the middle of that front shin there. And Dietrich was in the garage, Helmut was in the garage, all the mechanics were nervous because they just see me. I wasn't normal Mark, you can see I was, but I had to do this, and I didn't want to disrupt the program. New car, and normally we'd time the pit exit so the red light would go at the end of the day, and we would go onto the track so the red light would go off to green as we're going down the pit lane right on 9 o'clock. And I was so keen to do this lap myself. I want to do the installation of the car with all the mechanics, you know, outside myself. It's just they want to do the lap itself. So I drove out, timed, going down, we're at the other end, and a bit of a drive down to the pit exit. The light stayed red. It's red. I'm going, fuck, it needs to go green. And then it didn't go green. It stayed red. And so I stopped. And against all instinct, obviously, you can't go on the track with a red light. I'm like, oh. And then McLaren, Ferrari, all the guys are starting to come out around the car. So very, very quickly, it wasn't about Mark now. I'm like, shit, now the team, why is this track not going green? It was 9 o'clock on the clock. And then they're like, I'm saying, guys, I'm the radio gun guys, like, yeah, because I'm experienced enough now, this is not good. And Adrian went mental, because the guys had to pull the car. It was pretty much, we might as well have parked the car in the Ferrari garage. It was a fuck up.
And, this is it. I don't remember this story.
Yeah, I had to bring it all the way back. Get it back in. I'm like, oh, this is just not meant to be. I'm in there. My leg's on fire. Team's furious now. The whole thing's going peak time.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back. Anyway, the rest of the day was good.
And so then we fast forward. Do you feel that the leg slowed you down?
No.
In any way?
I had a little bit at the start of that year, but it made me really appreciate when you're 100% active that you are so lucky. You know, a bit of adversity like that when I was not, obviously when you're not mobile, I mean I could, you know, wipe my ass through the whole thing, but in terms of actually, you know, you need a bit of help early doors, and that's a real wake up call. So I'd often drive up to Nottingham, see Dave Hahn, and he'd say, mate, just keep eating well. I'd say, what can I do? He said, just keep eating well, do what I tell you, you know, rah rah. And I used to always stop at the petrol station and get two packets of ginormous minstrels.
That's what he meant, right?
Yeah. I remember those. They were gorgeous. And then, and there was another time I had a bit of work done on it, sort of halfway through, again, sort of 3 months in. And I rang him about, you know, 5 or 6 days later. I said, I think it's infected. So I took a photo, trying to set it up and rah, and he goes, you dickhead. What have you been doing? And he knew I'd been training. I'd been on the rowing machine. I'd been doing something with.
He could tell.
Yeah, he could tell.
Well, mate, it's the true Aussie grit thing, isn't it?
There we go.
Hey, is that where the Aussie grit thing came from? The fight that you had to...
I think earlier. I think, you know, just because when I left Australia, everyone said, 6 months, he'll be back. Probably. Most of the journo, you know, all the experts. Oh, yeah, mate, he'll be back. Nah, dreaming. And you just sort of think, well, it's a big responsibility on yourself, on that... I suppose tenacious hanging in there. Everyone's got levels or standards, right? Like some people, and there's people who've got more tenacity and more tenacious than I am. But in terms of what I had to show, I suppose, it's well known that in four wheels, you know, I mean, look at the New Zealand strike rate to get in Formula One. It's not great. Look at the Australian strike. You're four winners in 60, 70 years have we got.
Yeah.
It's not their best sport to try and pick to be good at.
Well, look, let's go back to life after Formula One now. It seems a good place to sign out, really. Because the Aussie... What are you? You're now a businessman. Is that what we call you? How do you want to... Clothing entrepreneur? What's it called? What's the clothing line called?
Aussie Grit Apparel. And as
where
you know,
that,
mate...
Where did that come from?
Well, because... I think because... I've always loved the outdoors. I've always spent a lot of time in the country growing up in Australia. And those early years turning professional, I'd often take myself into the snowy mountains in Australia on my own. And obviously, you know, good accommodation, don't get me wrong, but in terms of I'd train on my own, three sessions a day, swim, bike, run, or stretch in gym and run. And that was all done outside a gym, if you like. I love being in that environment. So I thought that I had a wardrobe full of lots of different brands that were doing a good job of each sort of garment here and there. And I thought, well, hang on a second. I think that I've met so many amazing people along the way, phenomenal athletes, phenomenal people, and they've been putting up also with sometimes a bit of mediocrity here and there in terms of, you know, whether it's whatever, skiing or, you know, any of their sort of chosen sports. And motor racing and sort of how we go about it systematically, sort of making things slightly better in every area that you can do. And I thought, well, let's encourage people to continue to play in that space, but give them the gear that they need.
So that's one part of modern Mark Webber, post-retirement. What a media?
Mm.
Yeah. Pundit?
Yeah.
Poacher turned gamekeeper? Is that how
big,
is that?
Yeah, well, a little bit. I use small bullets, though. I'm not. I'm pretty soft on the driver's
seat. I'm going to ask. Exactly. You are, right?
Yeah, of course. I don't really have a journalistic bone in my body, to be honest. I'm not overly.
If you have an inquisitive mind, same thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I'm fascinated with getting the best out. I want the drivers to look good, in terms of, you know, trying to again portray or ask the questions that, well, probably you'd like to be asked yourself when you're racing. But also, what are they going through? You know, the emotions of it all. Every weekend has a different dynamic to it. So I remember seeing DC at the end of my career, and he was doing that, and I was saying, why are you at the racetrack? What are you doing here? Go and do something else. And what's fascinating that I've found myself in a similar position. I'm not doing all the races like David is, but in terms of, I've done 10 Grand Prix this year for Channel 4, done a bit for Channel 10 in Australia, and then I see, you know, where I get offers from, obviously back in the Bernie days, to a Bernie said, can you do the podiums, can you start to do more for our sport? Because the relaxation factor and the chemistry obviously is there with the athletes or the people, which is obviously a key component. So I enjoy live TV. I enjoy
what bit of it?
I enjoy having to deliver a bit. You know, there's a bit of pressure there. You've got to educate the viewers at home, but not in a patronising way, because I've got to ask sometimes the obvious question that, you know, I know the answer to. I know the question sometimes the answer, which is also, you know, is that a bit, you know, mind-numbing? Can be, but you've got to ask it in a way that also the driver knows that I know the answer to the question, which is also a double whammy. So you think, God, that's amazing, that question, but, you know, the people at home. So there's interesting parts to that. So, yeah, there's the TV side. I've never been closer to Red Bull. I do work with them. I do some work with Rolex, and I do a lot of work with Porsche. So Porsche is my biggest... workload.
And then when you're talking about workload, I always think in Formula One, it's sort of the currency that a lot of people understand is number of flights. Are you making as many flights now, post-career, as you were as a racing driver?
Probably close, but much shorter flights, because I'm obviously bouncing around a lot within Europe. So long haul is definitely a lot less long haul. But yeah, I've certainly done the 15, you know, 15 to 18 flights per month in some months since I've stopped.
Talking about the heli, by the way.
Yeah, no heli. That's not flights. That's fun. But yeah, it's this evolves, you know, and the balance between, yeah, letting that, like we said at the top of the interview, the sort of the old Mark Webber, letting that slowly go and accepting the new part and family, friends. Like, I'd spend time with family and friends while I was racing. I was there physically, but mentally I wasn't there because I was so distracted with my profession, which was poor form from me, but that's just the way it was.
Did you realise that at the time?
Yeah, but I could, yeah, absolutely. But I couldn't part-mentalise it that well.
Yeah.
You know, just because I needed to, yeah, like I say, back to that word, intense.
Yeah.
And I was.
All right, and final thoughts. Do you think Formula One is in a good place at the minute? I mean, it's such a crucial time now in terms of the 2021 regulations and things.
Mm.
I think if you were the man...
Motorsport is in an interesting place right now. We've got this, you know, what is accepted that's risk, you know, that's gladiatorial. That's always been a key component for me for racing. People have to be able to watch something that other people can't do.
Were you pro or anti-Halo?
I was anti-Halo, but I mean, also, I don't, you know, it's natural that, you know, like they've always said, well, drivers had open face helmets for a long time, then they went to full face helmets. Well, did they not like those? Of course they didn't. For a while, then it's like, of course we need full face helmets now because we're doing, you know, you can't drive with an open face helmet at, you know, 220 mile an hour. I mean, they did, but it was like, you know, there was.
Is motorsport still relevant?
That's a topic because racing drivers, you know, I'd be fascinated to go to the DVLA and say, you know, the license, the waterline on license age in terms of appetite for driver's license. What's that done in the last 50 or 60 years? I reckon it's definitely decreased because it would have decreased. And also people less, you know, especially males. I mean, I'm splitting it a bit here, but in terms of, say, males to get a road license, I mean, that was just massive. So good to get your road license. I mean, brilliant.
Freedom.
Yeah. But now, I don't know, is it still like that? You know, where's it all going? Because we've got these, you know, other stimulations through tricking our minds through the screen because our eyeballs are looking at other things now and it's this thing that our mind is being stimulated in different ways. So we've got to be careful we don't give the drivers too much access to the fans. They need to be still, maybe not far as Bernie had it, but I think the drivers are getting nearly too familiar with the people. It's too trivial. It's too...
The process of meeting a driver.
Just social media, interviews, the way it is, the way we are presenting the drivers now is too familiar. And people lose a little bit of that stardust. You've got to be very careful with that. Roger Federer. Again, you know, he's approachable, but at competition time, no. He's not approachable because he's got a job to do. Is he doing interviews before Wimbledon? No, he's fucking not. So that's what we've got to be careful of.
You know, we were talking about who is the Roger Federer of Formula One. I think I'm looking at him.
No. Without the trophy cabinet. But, yeah, but it's, you know what I mean?
That's but the way you went about it, you must be proud. Listen, you must be proud, Mark, of the way you went about it.
Very. I am very, because...
Roger.
Yeah. Very. All the trophies are real in terms of, you know, there was, I felt that I got those correctly and I went about it the right way. And yeah, so that gives you good substance, yeah.
Great talking to you.
No worries, mate.
Thanks, Mark.
Cheers.
Roger Federer or not, I think Mark comes across as a man completely satisfied with his lot, happy with what he achieved as a racer and excited about the next chapter in his life, Aussie grit and all. Good on you, Mark. Thanks for your time. Now, next week, I'll be chatting to another big name from the world of F1, so please subscribe to Beyond the Grid to ensure you don't miss out. And you know the drill. Rate and review us. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on your favourite podcast app. And if you want to get in touch, drop us a line using the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid, and you can cyberstalk me at TomClarksonF1. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audio Boom. Until next time... keep it flat out.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.